Here's the thing, the short guy said. I always like to know who I'm doing business with. I nodded, smiled. What a jerk. If short man's disease were recognized by modern medicine as the serious syndrome it is, all the textbooks would use Philip Curtis's picture, along with those of Mussolini, Stalin, Attila the Hun, and of course the patron saint of all miniature tyrants, Napoleon Bonaparte. Granted, I'm over 6 foot, but I know tall guys with short man's disease, too. Philip Curtis, as he called himself, was so small and compact that I was convinced I could pick him up in one hand and hurl him through my office window, and by now I was sorely tempted to. He was maybe an inch or two above 5 feet, shiny bald, and wore enormous black-framed glasses, which he probably thought made him look more imposing, instead of like a turtle who'd lost his shell and was pissed off about it. The vintage Patek Philippe watch on his wrist had to be 60 years old. That told me a lot. It was the only flashy object he wore, and it said inherited money. His Patek Philippe had been passed down, probably from his dad. I checked you out, his brow arched significantly. Did the whole due diligence thing. Gotta say, you don't leave a lot of tracks. So I'm told. You don't have a website. Don't need one. You're not on Facebook. My teenage nephew's on it. Does that count? Barely anything turned up on Google, so I asked around. Seems you've got an unusual background. Went to Yale but never graduated. Did a couple of summer internships at McKinsey, huh? I was young. I didn't know any better. His smile was reptilian, but a small reptile. A gecko, maybe. I worked there myself. And I was almost starting to respect you, I said. The part I don't get is, you dropped out of Yale to join the army. What was that all about? Guys like us don't do that. Go to Yale? He shook his head, annoyed. You know, I thought the name Heller sounded familiar. Your dad's Victor Heller, right? I shrugged as if to say, you got me. Your father was a true legend. Is, I said. Excuse me? Is, I repeated. He's still alive, doing 20-some years in prison. Right, right. Well, he sure got the shaft, didn't he? So he tells people. My father, Victor Heller, the so-called Dark Prince of Wall Street, was currently serving a 28-year sentence for securities fraud. Legend was a polite way of referring to him. I was always a big admirer of your dad's. He was a real pioneer. Then again, I bet some potential clients, they hear you're Victor Heller's son, they're going to think twice about hiring you, huh? You think? You know what I mean, the whole... He faltered, then probably decided he didn't have to. He figured he'd made his point. But I wasn't going to let him off so easily. You mean like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, right? Like father, like son? Well, yeah, sort of. That might bother some guys, but not me. Uh-uh. Way I figure it, that means you're probably not going to be too finicky about the gray areas. The gray areas. All the fussy legal stuff. You know what I'm saying. Ah, gotcha, I said. For a long moment, I found myself looking out the window. I've been doing that a lot lately. I like the view. You could see right down High Street to the ocean, the waterfront at Rose Wharf framed by a grand Italianate marble arch. I moved to Boston from Washington a few months ago and was lucky enough to find an office in an old brick-and-beam building in the financial district, a rehabbed 19th-century lead pipe factory. From the outside, it looked like a Victorian poorhouse out of Dickens, but on the inside, with its bare brick walls and tall arched windows and exposed ductwork and factory floor open spaces, you couldn't forget it was a place where they used to actually make stuff. And I liked that. The other tenants in the building were consulting firms, an accounting firm, and several small real estate offices. On the first floor was an exotic sushi and tapas place that had gone out of business, and the showroom for Derdarian fine oriental rugs. My office had belonged to some high-flying dot-com that made nothing, including money. They'd gone bust suddenly and had to break their lease, so I caught a nice break on the price. They'd absconded so quickly, they left all their fancy hanging metal and glass light fixtures, and even some very expensive office chairs. So, you say someone on your board of directors is leaking derogatory information about your company, I said, turning around slowly. And you want us to, how'd you put it, plug the leak, right? Exactly. I gave him my finest conspiratorial grin, meaning you want their phones tapped and their emails accessed. Hey, you're a pro, he said with a quick, smarmy wink. I'd never tell you how to do your job. Better not to know the details, right? How we work our magic? He nodded a couple of quick, sharp up and downs. Plausible deniability and all that, you got it. Of course. Obviously you know that what you're asking me to do is basically illegal. We're both big boys, he said. I had to bite my lip. One of us was, anyway. Just then my phone buzzed, an internal line, and I picked it up. Yeah? Okay, you were right. The smoky voice of my forensic data tech, Dorothy Duval. His name isn't Philip Curtis. Of course, I said. Don't rub it in. Not at all, I said. It's a teachable moment. You should know by now not to question me. Yeah, well, I'm stuck. If you have any ideas, just IM me and I'll check them out. Thanks, I said, and I hung up. The man who wasn't Philip Curtis had a strong Chicago accent. Wherever he lived now, he was raised in Chicago. He had a rich dad. The hand-me-down Patek Philippe confirmed that. Then there was the black luggage tag on his Louis Vuitton briefcase, a fractional jet card. He leased a private jet for some limited number of hours per year, which meant he wanted a private jet, but couldn't afford one. I had a vague recollection of an item I had seen on BizWire about troubles in a family-held business in Chicago. Will you excuse me for just one more minute? I said, I have to put out a fire. Then I typed out an instant message and sent it to Dorothy. The answer came back less than a minute later, a Wall Street Journal article she'd pulled up on ProQuest. I skimmed it, and I knew I'd guessed right. I remember hearing the whole sordid story not too long ago. Then I leaned back in my chair. So, here's the problem, I said. Problem? I'm not interested in your business. Stunned, he whirled around to look at me. What did you just say? If you really did your homework, you know that I do intelligence work for private clients. I'm not a private investigator. I don't tap phones and I don't do divorces. And I'm sure as hell not a family therapist. Family? This is clearly a family squabble, Sam. Small, round, pink spots had formed high on his cheeks. I told you, my name is... Don't even bother, I said, wearily. This has nothing to do with plugging a leak. Your family troubles aren't exactly a secret. You were supposed to take over Daddy's company until he heard you were talking to the private equity guys about taking Richter private and cashing out. I have no idea what you're referring to. His father, Jacob Richter, had gone from owning a parking lot in Chicago to creating the largest luxury hotel chain in the world. Over 105 star hotels in 40 countries, plus a couple of cruise lines, shopping malls, office buildings, and a hell of a lot of real estate. A company valued at $10 billion. So Dad gets pissed off, I went on, and squeezes you out and appoints Big Sis chief executive officer and heir apparent instead of you. Didn't expect that, did you? You figured you were a shoo-in. But you're not going to put up with that, are you? Since you know all of Dad's dirty laundry, you figure you'll get him on tape making one of his shady real estate deals, offering kickbacks and bribes, and you'll be able to blackmail your way back in. I guess that's called winning ugly, right? Sam Richter's face had gone dark red, almost purple. A couple of bulging veins on top of his scalp were throbbing so hard, I thought he was going to have a coronary right in the middle of my office. Who did you talk to? He demanded. Nobody. Just did the whole due diligence thing. I always like to know who I'm doing business with. And I really don't like being lied to. As Richter lurched to his feet, he shoved the chair, one of the expensive human-scale office chairs left by the dot-com, and it crashed to the floor, leaving a visible dent in the old wood. From the doorway, he said, "You know, for a guy whose father who's in prison for fraud, you sure are acting all high and mighty." "You've got a point," I conceded. "Sorry to waste your time. Mind showing yourself out?" Behind him, Dorothy was standing, arms folded. "Victor Heller was the scum of the earth," he sputtered. "Is," I corrected him. Chapter 4. "You don't tap phones," Dorothy said, arms folded, moving into my office. I smiled, shrugged. "I always forget you listen in. Someday that's going to get me in trouble." Our standard arrangement was for her to monitor all client meetings via the IP video camera built into the huge desktop monitor on my desk. "You don't tap phones," she said again. Her lips were pressed into a smirk. "Mm-hmm." "As a general rule," I said. "Please," she said, "you hire guys to do it." Exactly. What the hell was that all about? She snapped with a fierce glare. Dorothy and I had worked together at Stoddard Associates in D.C. before I moved to Boston and stole her away. She wasn't really a computer genius. There were certainly more knowledgeable ones around, but she knew digital forensics inside and out. She'd worked at the National Security Agency for 9 years, and they don't hire just anyone. As much as she detested working there, they'd trained her well. More important, no one was as stubborn as Dorothy. She simply did not give up, and there was no one more loyal. She was feisty and blunt-spoken and didn't play well with others, which was why she and the NSA were a lousy fit. But it was one of the things I liked about her. She never held back. She loved telling me off and showing me up and proving me wrong. And I enjoyed that, too. You did not want to mess with her. You heard me. I don't like liars. Get over it. We need the business, and you've turned down more work than you've taken on. I appreciate your concern, I said. But you don't need to worry about the firm's cash flow. Your salary's guaranteed. Until Heller Associates goes bust because the overhead's too high and you got no income, I'm not slinking back to Jay Stoddard, and I am not moving back to Washington. Don't worry about it. I'd worked closely with Dorothy, even intimately, but I knew almost nothing about her personal life. She never talked about her love life, and I never asked. I wasn't even sure whether she preferred men or women. Everyone's entitled to their zone of privacy. She was an attractive, striking woman with mocha skin, liquid brown eyes, and an incandescent smile. She always dressed elegantly, even though she didn't need to, since she rarely met with clients. Today she was wearing a shimmering lilac silk blouse and a black pencil skirt and some kind of strappy heels. She wore her hair extremely short, almost bald, in fact. On most women that might look bizarre, but on her it somehow worked. Attached to her earlobes were turquoise copper enamel discs the size of frisbees. Dorothy was a mass of contradictions, which was another thing I liked about her. She was a regular churchgoer. Even before she'd found an apartment, she'd joined an AME Zion church in the South End. But she was no church lady. The opposite, in fact. She had an almost profane sense of humor about her faith. She'd put a plaque on her cubicle wall that said, "Jesus loves you. Everyone else thinks you're an asshole." Right next to the one that said, "I love Mary's baby daddy." "I think we need to have regular status update meetings like we used to do at Stoddard," she said. "I want to go over the Antronics case and the Garrison case." "I need coffee first," I said, "and not that swill that Jillian makes." Jillian Alperin, our receptionist and office manager, was a strict vegan. Veganism is apparently the paramilitary wing of vegetarianism. She had multiple piercings, including one on her lip, and several tattoos. One was of a butterfly on her right shoulder. I'd caught a glimpse of another one on her lower back, too, one day. She was also a green fanatic who had banned all styrofoam and paper cups in the office. Everything had to be organic, ethical, free-range, fair trade, and cruelty-free. The coffee she ordered for the office machine was organic, fair trade, shade-grown, ethical beans grown using sustainable cultivation methods by a small co-op of indigenous peasant farmers in resistance in Chiapas, Mexico. It cost as much as Bolivian cocaine and probably would have been rejected by a death row inmate. "Well, aren't you fussy?" Dorothy said. "There's a Starbucks across the street." "There's a Dunkin' Donuts down the block," I said. "That better not be a hint. I don't do coffee." "I know better than to ask," I said, getting up. The phone rang, the muted internal ring. Jillian's voice came over the intercom. "A Marshall Marcus for you?" "The Marshall Marcus," Dorothy said. "As in the richest guy in Boston?" I nodded. "You turn this one down, Nick, and I'm gonna whip your butt." "I doubt it's a job," I said. "Probably personal." I picked up the phone and said, "Marshall. Long time." "Nick," he said, "I need your help. Alexa's gone."